international finance, stock markets and exchanges. We want to understand the nature, structure and operation of stock markets and exchanges and other forms of over-the-counter or off-exchange activity. I have provided a set of materials which include two key chapters which examine the nature of financial markets exchanges, and then second chapter reviews all the main primary financial markets and exchanges in Europe and refers to some of the other main markets in the world. I've also made available a set of slides online, and we will work through those, through these, and then highlight the key points from the chapters. What we're going to do is this: we're going to look at origin and development. We'll consider securities and exchanges, restructuring and competition, electronic trading and internal order books, scandal and crisis, regulatory challenge. We'll come back to all of this because it's referred to in further detail in the papers, but we need to understand all of the core basic aspects before we come on to this. These are just photographs, images from some of the most beautiful stock markets and exchanges as they grew and evolved over time. I think this was the original New York Stock Exchange. This is called the Buttonwood. This is where the broker dealers used to originally meet and deal under a tree in the 17 and 1800s. Again, this is in New York. That's the beginning of what will become the formal stock market and exchange. These are early drawings of what will become the main New York Stock Exchange. It's a very beautiful building. It's a very impressive building. We'll come back over and we'll refer to the history of all of this and the development of markets, and then look at the different types of markets. Many markets have moved from being auction or pit-based markets, whereby the broker-dealers are actually on the market and they're using hand signals to conduct all the trades. Everything is now done on screen, although there's two main types of markets we'll need to consider. You've basically got order-based systems and you've got quote-based systems or quote-driven systems. In an order-based market, what's happening is buyers are putting forward offers, sellers putting forward their offers, and when the transactions match, the deal's completed. So it's almost, it's selective, it's almost accidental. The transaction will not complete, it will not undertake until the two parties, the offers that are being made, match. So that's order matching. Most traditional historical markets are order based. More modern systems are quote based, which means that the broker dealer is making a market. That means that they're providing open prices at all times to purchase and buy, and there'll be a spread between them. So they're always offering to buy at this price and they're always offering to sell at that price, with the spread being the difference. These are markets, market making, where you've also got an available price which you can conclude at. With a order deal, when the transactions match, the transactions automatically completed and then you go into execution. When you have quote-driven systems, the quote is the offer to contract, so not until that's actually accepted by the other party does the contract complete. So there's just some slight fine divisions, changes in law with regards to the operation of these systems and markets, and we'll come back and look at all of this in further detail. So this is the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, on which I have been a number of times. It's actually very interesting indeed to see it. And this actually is Starbucks. There's a coffee shop on the floor of the corner of the New York Stock Exchange. This is the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. This is inside. This is Hong Kong. This is Japan. This is Shanghai. And I've provided other photographs on the system with regards to the operation of these markets. Now, what we're going to look at is this difference between financial markets and instruments. We have to understand you've got the capital markets, you've got the money markets, you've got the euro dollar markets, we've got the currency markets. I explain and deal with all of this in the paper. Financial derivatives markets, gold markets, commodity markets, and insurance markets. We'll come back to all of that. I provide separate presentations, separate materials on all of this on the system, although it's also dealt with at the beginning of the stock market and exchanges chapters. We will specifically come on to look at financial markets and exchanges, securities and claims, and then the difference between primary and secondary markets. This is distinct in the securities area as opposed to the money area, the banking and credit area. In the money market sphere, the primary money market is the market in which the central bank will deal with a small group of selected preferred large commercial banks. So the primary money market is the market in which the central bank is dealing, mainly for liquidity purposes, daily market liquidity, and for emergency support. We call that lender of last resort. This is sometimes called the gilt market, or in London, it's the primary money market. That's the one in which the central bank intervenes. The secondary money markets are markets that buy and sell other types of wholesale debt provided by other wholesale counterparties, such as local authorities, companies, the interbank market, the commercial paper market, sterling commercial deposit, CD market, certificate of deposit market. These are specialist wholesale markets for particular types of debt issued by other wholesale counterparties. Because it's a money market, that means it's wholesale and up to 1 year. So the primary money market is the market in which the central bank deals. Secondary money markets are markets in which other types of debt instruments are dealt with. In the securities area, the primary market is the market in which you bring the security onto the market for the first time, whether it's equity, a share, or whether it's a bond. Equity or shares, you're actually buying a proportionate interest in a company. You actually own a part of the company, valued on a going concern basis. If you hold a share, you receive a dividend payment, you have information rights, and you have voting rights that you can exercise as shareholders, either in annual general meetings or in special general meetings. If you are a bondholder, you don't actually own anything in the company as such. A bond is just a promise to pay, an undertaking to make payment issued by the company or government concerned. In that case, you still have information rights, but they're more limited. You still have voting rights, but they're much more limited. And in place of a dividend, which is a share of the profit, you receive an interest payment. So we have equity and we have bonds. These are the two primary types of securities. The primary money market is the market the central banks deal in. The primary securities market is when you bring these shares and securities onto the market for the first time. The secondary capital market is then when you buy and sell them. So they become secondary instruments, just bought and sold between other counterparties after you've brought them to the market for the first time. We'll also look at market operation. We'll refer to auction markets, exchange markets, electronic markets, OTC markets, order book markets. We'll look at market structure, non-profit mutuals, profit mutuals or cooperatives, and then corporate bodies. This is part of the demutualization process. Earlier markets historically were simply almost like gentlemen's clubs. There were associations which were owned by the members. There were members' clubs. What would then happen is you demutualize by converting yourself into a legal entity, either a private company or a public company, and you sell your shares. If you sell your shares to the general public, what you can then do is deal with those shares on the market itself. So you will demutualize, you issue shares, and then you admit those trades on the market itself. And we'll come back to talk about admission to listing and admission to trading. Admission to listing means you go on an approved list to sell securities to the general public. Those could be shares or they could be bonds. Admission to trading is when you get consent to trade a specific bond or security on a particular market. We'll also then look at corporate bodies. When you demutualize, what you will do is you will set up a formal company as a legal entity, either as a private company or a public company. That is part of this demutualization process we've referred to. Most modern markets are now fully demutualized, although many of them took a long time to get to that stage, often hundreds of years. We'll then talk about market function. This was very interesting when I wrote these chapters. I couldn't find anything on this anywhere else. I couldn't find a basic explanation of what the core functions and purposes of stock markets were. When I was writing this, I had to come up with a series of definitions to define all the key terms, but also consider, for the first time almost, core issues like what is market function. As I understand it, the key purpose of a market and exchange is price disclosure initially, trading and dealing, clearing, settlement, and then trade and transaction reporting. And we'll come back and look at all of this in further detail. We'll also mention market trading. You have what we call, we've already mentioned this, order-based markets and quote-driven systems. But we can also have dealer markets, limit order book markets, open outcry, call or batch trading, and then we'll mention market orders as well. Market orders, limit orders, and stop orders. This is how the actual trading is conducted on many formal stock markets and exchanges, as well on an over-the-counter basis. I've just provided some other additional photographs. These are the two primary custodians. This is Euroclear and Clearstream. This is what they look like. Basically, all of the bonds which are issued in the world are almost always immobilized, which means they are sent to these two custodians and they're held there. If there's any secondary dealing, it's conducted across the accounts of these two bodies, and then there's an optical fiber link between Euroclear and Clearstream. Euroclear is in Brussels, Clearstream is in Luxembourg, so you can conduct the transactions in international bonds across the systems themselves and across the accounts between the two principal custodian holders. All of the largest commercial banks and securities firms will have accounts with both of these entities. And what will happen is, if you want to deal in securities with any other company outside these two, they will have an agency relationship with members of these two accounts so that the actual trading can be conducted over their separate accounts. So this is Euroclear and Clearstream. And I've provided other photographs. There's a longer list of photographs on the system. These are just some of the other principal markets. You've got the London Stock Exchange, the London International Financial Futures Exchange, VertX, OM Group, London Metal Exchange, International Petroleum Exchange, Alternative Trading Systems. CREST is the UK Electronic Clearing and Settlement System. And you've also got the separate London Clearing House and Gilt Clearing. In terms of other international markets, United States and Canada, you have the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, and you have NASDAQ, which is the North American Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. And then also in North America, you have the Toronto Stock Exchange. Other European exchanges include Euronext, Deutsche Börse and Eurex, OMX Group in Sweden, BME, Spanish exchanges. Other international exchanges include Borsa Italiana, the Irish Stock Exchange, Athens Stock Exchange, and the Swiss Stock Exchange. In Asia, you have Tokyo Stock Exchange, Hong Kong Stock Exchange, China, Taiwan, Australia, and then you have the Hang Seng Shanghai as well. There's a series of other additional specific issues which arise with regards to the development and change in growth in these markets concerning digital competition, financial innovation, capital role in private investment, financial security, financial instability, and then financial integration and global contribution. And I deal with all of these in further detail in the two papers provided. These are the two core chapters which are made available, one on financial markets and exchanges, and the other on exchange review, regulation, and evolution. The key larger principles, including legal and regulatory issues, are dealt with in the first chapter, and then the second chapter looks at some of the most important key markets in further detail. All of this is provided in the papers made available. In terms of total global size, what we have is this. There's around 964 markets in the world, 964. There's 80 at least major stock markets and exchanges. These are worth $110.2 trillion, $110.2 trillion. 42.4% of that, that's over two-thirds, almost a half, exists on the capitalization of the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, which is the electronic exchange system in North America, together. So the combined capitalization, capital value of the New York Stock Exchange and the electronic system in North America is 42.4%, which makes up almost half of our $102.2 trillion market across the world. This is what we're looking at. very important, very significant. This is basically how many of the largest companies in the world and governments in the world will raise funds in practice. There's a number of core background issues and points that we need to make to understand all of this, and I've set all of that out in the introductory part of this chapter. What we're looking at is this. Financial markets have been subject to fundamental change in recent decades. This has included very substantial growth and change in the area of banking and then securities and insurance company expansion. The banks expanded during the 1960s and 70s. The insurance companies did not start to expand and operate on a cross-border basis until the 1980s and the 1990s, simply because the telecommunications didn't allow it. The efficiency and power of the computer systems and then the telecommunication, digital telephony, was not available at that time. It was not powerful enough, so we couldn't create the electronic systems that we needed to allow for cross-border conduct of trading business. That only emerges much later in the 80s and 90s, while banks had been expanding in the 1960s onward in the post-war period. A lot of this was driven by massive improvements in telecommunications and software and hardware support, which very substantially increased the speed, reliability, cost and security of almost all types of financial transaction and activity. All of this was then supported by significant, substantial deregulation in markets across the world. This was partly legal and regulatory deregulation, but also very importantly in terms of capital mobility. The United Kingdom and other key financial centres in Europe adopted open capital markets from around 1979 onwards into the 1980s. Other countries, so that was the UK, Sweden, North America, Sweden, the Netherlands, France would come a little later in the early 1970s, mainly led by the change in the senior officials in France at that time. Jacques Delors became the head of the finance ministry at the beginning of the 1980s under President Mitterrand. He would then subsequently become the president of the European Commission. It was decided at that time that France would also adopt the practices adopted in the other North European countries, such as the United Kingdom and Sweden, to go for full open capital mobility. There had been earlier restrictions on capital movement to try and protect the domestic integrity and the monetary policy and capital position of countries. It was perceived that capital controls were important at that stage. All of this would later be abandoned as we moved on to open capital type systems, which allowed movement to funds to flow much more easily and fluently across the world. This was then taken forward in the European Union itself with the appointment of Jacques Delors as the President of the European Commission for the period between around 1984 and 1992. And during that era, Europe would adopt an open capital policy, and that's what supports the development and expansion of a single banking market and then a single securities market and insurance market. If it had not been for that change, that substantial deregulation in international capital mobility and payments policy, we would not have achieved all of the later very substantial successes which were realised and generated. What we also have is a significant growth in securitisation. In the 1960s, it was always possible to raise large amounts of funds either in the loan market, the syndicated lending market, or in the bond market. But what would then happen during the early 1970s? The loan market would collapse by about a factor of four, and the bond market would expand by a corresponding factor of four. And what we got was a substantial transfer of activity from the loan markets into the securities markets as part of a larger process of securitization. Now, why was that relevant? It was principally driven by the additional transferability and negotiability of securities, bonds and shares in the capital markets, which increased liquidity. So it became possible always to borrow more at a finer rate and lower cost of payment, finer coupon rate in the capital markets than the banking markets. Unless there was some specific complexity or difficulty which prevented a company, an issuer, going into the capital markets to try and issue bonds or shares, you would go back to the loan market. But otherwise, you would always try to raise funds in the capital markets because you could raise more at a finer rate. This also had further consequential benefits in terms of transferability, which allowed for improvements in portfolio and risk management. We had increased liquidity, as I've mentioned, lower cost of funding, as well as enhanced flexibility and efficiency. We've also got this process, as I've mentioned before, about immobilization and dematerialization. What would happen is, in the bond market specifically, the bonds are issued by companies. They would almost always, because they're negotiable instruments, which means title transfers by delivery, it would be very easy to steal and then plan transfer on title. For that reason, for security purposes, almost all of the bonds would be immobilized. That means that they would be physically deposited with the two clearing houses we've mentioned, Clearstream and Euroclear, as core custodians in the Eurodollar market. The bonds would then remain there for the whole of the duration of their lives, whether it was 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or plus. You would immobilize them. What would then happen is all secondary trading was then carried out across the accounts of the member participants of both Euroclear and Clearstream. And as I've already explained, there's a fiber optic cable between Euroclear and Clearstream so that you could conduct transactions between the two custodians as well. What then happened was we had the subsequent process of dematerialization, where the bonds are issued in an electronic format. There is no physical security, so there is no strict immobilization, but still there is an electronic digital form of immobilization because the bonds would still be held only with these two core custodians. What we then see is that markets are driven by a large number of significant factors and changes. We had increased pressures, including automation, diversification, innovation, competition, and over time, integration. With substantial improvements in price information collection, management, and dissemination, which included a switch from floor trading and dealing to new electronic forms of transactions. This leads to the emergence of a series of new specific types of stock markets and exchanges. We collectively referred to these earlier as electronic trading systems or electronic trading platforms, that's ETSs and ATPs. In the United States, these are specifically referred to as electronic communications networks or ECNs. Within the European Union, we talk about multilateral trading facilities, MTFs, and organized trading facilities, OTFs. What we have is this huge process of dematerialization, of disintermediation, as well as the transfer of activities from physical systems onto electronic trading as we move away from old, more traditional types of physical markets with a pit whereby the traders would buy and sell, dealing with each other directly, to electronic screen-based trading and electronic screen-based systems. All of this was also driven by a powerful movement in terms of privatization. What was also happening was there was substantial new interest in investment in securities markets as part of the securitization we referred to before. This also occurs in countries specifically like North America, where private pension provision becomes very important. A lot of this is managed through what's called 401ks, 401k programs under section 401k of the Inland Revenue Code in North America, whereby employees would develop a pension plan and that would be matched by investment from their employers so they could develop substantial private investment provision. This all provides further attention with a shift in focus to private markets as people became more responsible for their own investments, their own investment decisions, and their own pension provision longer term. We now live at the beginning of a new financial era. We now live with the massive potential new benefits and advantages which are provided through electronic and digital systems, although this also still creates its own vulnerabilities, and we have to be aware of these and we have to attempt to manage these. What I do in the paper is I explain the circumstances leading up to the global financial crisis. I outline all of the key elements within that and the impact and some of the principal changes that were adopted in response to the crisis. The key point to make simply is this. We go from this wider, larger phase, period of deregulation in markets during the late 1970s and into the 1980s, 1990s, up until the early 2000s, and then we're going to get a substantial re-regulation of the markets as we adopt new controls to try and ensure longer term market health and stability. There had been a number of specific developments in the United States in terms of deregulation through the 1980s and 1990s. These culminated in what was called the Financial Competitiveness Act 1999, or the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which very substantially deregulated markets in the United States. It essentially abolished the earlier restriction imposed under the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act 1933, which separated separated banking, commercial banking, and securities business in the United States, which was imposed under Glass-Steagall. The Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act allowed the creation of financial holding companies which could own subsidiaries involved in both areas, with a bank or a securities firm also becoming a financial holding company. This very substantially removes the earlier restrictions, which allows banking and markets, banking and securities markets, to become much more closely integrated in the United States. We also had what was called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act 2000, which very significantly opened up the derivatives markets in the United States, and in particular the over-the-counter OTC market, which supported the development of specifically credit default swaps across financial use in complex markets, which allowed us to provide additional credit cover for underlying loan instruments. These two key pieces of statute led to a substantial liberalisation, opening of United States markets, which many consider were key factors in the development of the conditions that led up to the global financial crisis beginning in 2007 and 2008. What we then had was a substantial re-regulation and imposition of new controls following this period. All of that I then pick up later in substantial detail at the end of this chapter. In terms of historical development, we've always had the ability to buy and sell. But what happened in earlier times is that most trading was conducted between close family relations or closed communities. We only needed to develop what we call financial intermediaries and financial intermediation as markets begin to open up, in particular after the end of the medieval period from the 1200s onwards. What we then see is a very substantial expansion in trading and finance activity across Europe. This initially grew from fairs in villages and towns to then country fairs, and then to large cross-border fairs, which would occur in major cities across North America, including, for example, Bruges, Antwerp, Lyon. What would happen is that merchants would come together, they would meet during these periods, the fairs themselves could then last days, if not weeks, possibly even months, with the great fairs, and they led to the development of a number of key modern elements or components in sophisticated financial systems, including, for example, bills of exchange and promissory notes. And what would later happen is the bill of exchange would be transformed into the check, which is essentially a bill of exchange drawn on a bank. The first private bank was the Monte de Paschi, set up in Siena in 1472. The first public clearinghouse was the Casa di San Giorgio, set up in Genoa in 1407. The first core security was the Monte Comune that was developed in Venice and then traded in Florence subsequently. It was a public debt whereby the new city states would raise funds by issuing public debt instruments into the markets, which would have a perpetual repayment, with this being covered, the interest payments met by subsequent taxation and income receipts to the state. The very first formal exchange was set up in Antwerp in 1460. We then had later stock markets emerging in Lyon in 1540, Hamburg in 1555, Amsterdam in 1602, and then Paris in 1724. The first formal stock market is recognized as Paris 1724, which had 60 agents de change, which would conduct business, and they actually developed their own separate market code of conduct to regulate dealing and dealing practices at that time. Trading in London emerged in coffee shops, in coffee houses. This began with Jonathan Miles' coffee shop in 1680, which would then become Jonathan's Coffee House in 1698. From around 1698 onwards, John Casting would actually post prices of stocks and commodities on documents made available through the stock exchange in pamphlets. The stock exchange itself would formally be set up in 1773. In the United States, Wall Street begins in 1792, although the New York Stock Exchange and Board was not formally established until 1817, although there was earlier trading, including under the Buttonwood Treaty that I've mentioned before. The first stock market in North America was in Philadelphia in 1790. There was some contraction, some limiting of business up to the First World War, between the First World War and the Second World War, although much of this would then expand substantially again after the Second World War. We then see the emergence of these new electronic markets, beginning with the establishment of the NASDAQ in 1971. That's the North American Security Dealers Automated Quotations System. Is the largest electronic trading market in the United States. As we've already mentioned, the two largest markets in the world are still the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, which have a combined value of around $45 trillion in combined capitalization. This was then supported by a series of big bangs. There was a big bang in New York around 1975, which substantially opened up the markets, and another big bang in the United Kingdom around 1986. What had actually happened was that the London Stock Exchange had been referred to the Restrictive Practices Court by the Office of Fair Trading in 1979. It concluded that there was a number of anti-competitive practices. So the effect of the big bang in London in 1986 was to allow for the abandonment of earlier fixed commissions, which meant that transaction costs were too high, as well as to allow non-markets to join the exchange and to allow for foreign ownership. So what actually happened was a large number of financial institutions, including banks and securities firms, all around the world, in particular in North America and Japan and Europe, would move into London and buy up all of the old earlier stock markets in stock market firms, the investment banks in the United Kingdom. And then the third thing was that the earlier distinction between a stock broker and a stock jobber was abandoned. A stock broker dealt with on an agency basis on behalf of clients. A stock jobber was a market maker. What then happened was we abolished this earlier division, this distinction between the two, which was regarded to be anti-competitive, with all new participants in these stock markets becoming broker-dealers. They're dual-capacity broker-dealers, which is the modern model. Until this, we had the separation of agency or brokerage and primary market making, primary market trading. The other key event was this, that the London Stock Exchange itself then demutualizes at this point. So we're going to create a separation between admission to listing and admission to trading. Admission to listing involves permission to sell to the general public. Admission to trading means you become listed and can make trades on a specific stock market and exchange. What had happened was the London Stock Exchange was the listing authority until this time. Because it demutualized, the decision was taken that responsibility for listing had to be transferred to another agency, which becomes the Financial Services Authority and then the Financial Conduct Authority. The background to all of this I expand and develop in further detail in the papers provided. What then happens is a number of specific types of markets and exchanges are set up under the new, what becomes the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, which establishes the new regulatory structure within the United Kingdom. That's the FSME 2000. And what we're going to do is this. We're going to create a series of specific entities under this new regulatory system, which will include a number of particular types of regulatory function. So what we have is this. We essentially have recognised investment exchanges, which are the key stock markets. We have recognised overseas investment exchanges. We have recognised clearing houses. And then we also have designated investment exchanges. So that's RIEs, ROIEs, RCHs and DIEs. There's also a further classification or category of what we call recognised platforms or recognised auction platforms. Now, some of the largest RIEs, I mentioned all of this in the paper and in the material provided, although it's also available in the lists provided on the Financial Conduct Authority website. So the largest RIEs, recognised investment exchanges, now include London Stock Exchange, the London Metal Exchange, Aqua Stock Exchange, CBOE, that's the Chicago Board, Europe Limited. You've also got ICE, Futures Exchange Limited. You've got IPSX UK Limited. Recognised clearinghouses include ASX Settlement, Austrian Control Bank, the Board of Trade, that's in Chicago, Clearing Corporation, the Commodity Clearing Corporation, a series of others, such as the OM Stockholm Exchange Options Clearing Corporation. Designated investment exchanges include the American Stock Exchange, Australian Stock Exchange, the Bolsa Mexicana de Valores, the Bourse de Montreal. The principal RAP is the ICE Futures Europe that we mentioned before. Recognised overseas investment exchanges will then include NASDAQ that we've mentioned, as well as specific NASDAQ Stockholm, NASDAQ Copenhagen, and now NASDAQ Helsinki as well, and the Chicago Board of Options Exchange Europe, Deutsche Börse, Eurex in Frankfurt, Euronext in Amsterdam, Euronext in Paris. So the large number of these markets, which are now recognised for regulatory purposes and monitored, reviewed, and subject to specific obligations as imposed under the Financial Services and Markets on, as we've said, RIEs, RCHs, DIEs, RAPs, and ROIEs. The paper then examines in further detail the nature of electronic systems. So we're now looking again at alternative trading platforms, United States Electronic Communications Networks, ECNs, as well as EU multilateral trading facilities and organised trading exchanges. Basically, an electronic trading system is a collective term for any form of digital electronic marketplace, which I define in the paper. Alternative trading system is a more specific type of exchange. Alternative trading platform is a specific type of secondary level exchange recognised in the United States. The US system is generally based on this designation of electronic communication networks, or ECNs. It's a computerized system that automatically matches buy and sell orders for securities in the market. Multilateral trading facilities are the European term used under the Financial Markets and Instruments Directive, the MIFID. This allows for the trading on an electronic basis in financial instruments as defined within the European Union system. An organised trading facility is a specific type of MTF where there's more discretion given to the parties. with regards to the management and matching of the orders. The final type of exchange to note is what we call an internal order book. Internalization arises where a specific financial firm, such as a large investment bank or a securities firm, actually conducts a market inside its own operations, inside its own systems. Because these firms are very large and will have a large number of clients placing orders both ways, so they're acting on an agency basis on behalf of their clients, these internalizers or this process of internalization or internal book system, what actually happens is the banks and securities firms effectively create their own internal stock market inside themselves to buy and sell securities between their clients on an agency basis. This declined somewhat with a lot of the heavier regulation imposed in Europe, but I understand it's still important and still a significant part of the market. So internalization or an internal order book is a specific type of internal stock market within a larger institution. The paper then looks at different types of risk, as well as more recent financial crises and financial incidents in the markets, as well as explains the different types of markets. We also go on subsequently to look at particular definitions which apply to key terms such as securities and claims, and I develop this further in the paper. So a security is a type of transferable financial asset or a claim that either represents a debt obligation issued by a government or corporate body or an interest in the body concerned. This alternatively may be used to refer to collateral or credit support. Historically, this consisted of debt obligations issued by bodies, by government agencies or bodies, and the security referred to the collateral, the secured nature of the obligation created. This now also includes equity and shares, as well as bonds, as we've explained already, and I explain the development of the English common law with regards to securities and the nature of the definitions developed in the paper. So you'll see, for example, reference to Borland's trustee versus Steel Brothers and Co. Farwell J stated that a share is the interest of a shareholder in the company measured by a sum of money for the purpose of liability in the first place and of interest in the second, but also consisting of a series of, and this is the key part, mutual covenants entered into by all of the shareholders inter se under the then Companies Act 1862. And I explain and develop this further in the paper with regards to the background and development of these key definitions under English law. The paper then goes on to consider the nature of markets and market systems. We distinguish, as we've explained already, primary markets and secondary markets, and then look at market operations in further detail. So what we have are initially option markets. An auction is an organized system for determining the price of an asset, principally through open bidding. That's an auction. An exchange is a formalized, organized marketplace for the buy and sell, purchase and sale of securities, usually with a physical location. But then we've now got electronic markets or electronic exchanges, which is a system which allows for the sale and purchase of the same securities, but this time on an electronic basis without the need for any physical operations. This is essentially screen-based, and as we've already mentioned, this is principally now taken up through the development of alternative trading systems, alternative trading platforms, electronic communication networks, multilateral trading facilities, and organized trading facilities. We also have the key division between traded and over-the-counter markets. So we've got what we call over-the-counter systems, OTC. This is basically where trades are conducted between institutions directly without the need to go back onto a formal market or exchange. This is part of this, again, larger process of privatization of activity, whereby we can do it through institutions directly without the need to go into formal stock markets and exchanges. Very often when we're looking at internalization and the fact that large investment firms, securities firms or banks will create their own internal order book, they will still, at the end of the day, very often go back onto a formal stock market exchange to clear out the final payments for that day. We've also then got, as I've said, this order book system, which essentially operates through a form of internal market making or internalized systems with the institutions as necessary going on to formal markets to settle or clear out any residual positions. In terms of market structure, there's three key sets of organizations we need to look at. Non-profit mutuals. Profit mutuals are corporations, cooperatives, and then body corporates. As we've said, many stock markets and exchanges originally were established as informal associations, basically clubs or members' clubs. And they could operate on this basis very successfully for a substantial period of time because membership was closed and the governance was easy to conduct with substantial controls on exit and entry, which then protected the system, as we've said, as we saw before, which can actually lead to more anti-competitive practices. What would then happen is we would have the demutualization of these non-legally based systems so that they would convert themselves into companies or entities and then become either a private company or a public company. And then if they were a public company, they would actually list their own shares on their own markets as they develop them. So we have this general move over time from non-profit membership-only organizations to profit-based mutual or cooperative systems, then to finally modern private and public company structures. In terms of market function, as I explained before, I had to consider this for the first time because I could not find any separate examination or consideration of this. What is the purpose of a stock market and exchange? I've developed all of the key definitions. I've then expanded on all of the core terms in the paper. So the core question was then, what is the function of a stock market and exchange? I think when it can identify five key functions in terms initially of price disclosure. The purpose of a market is to determine the appropriate price for the particular security at any point in time. So the initial primary purpose always is price disclosure, which will be made available to the general public. This is the key mechanism. This initially was dealt with through the bid and offer process itself. This can now be supported by the screen-based systems and then the whole panoply of supporting research, which now is made available in modern market systems so that we can actually most accurately price a security at any point in time, with large volumes of reports always being available as to whether particular markets are overpriced or underpriced, and specific securities issued by, for example, particular companies or governments is at the right level. Massive amount of financial information and analysis now supports all of this. So price disclosure is the core primary function. We then have, from a legal perspective, the trading or dealing. We actually have to conduct the purchase and sale. We actually have to convert this into an enforceable contract and actually give legal effect to this. So you've got the actual trading and dealing itself. This will be supported by the core local legal system, which will determine the conditions which apply with regards to offer, acceptance, and then conclusion of the contract so that the contract becomes fully enforceable. We then have two other key related ideas. That's clearing and settling. What clearing involves is determining net positions between particular sets of counterparties. What will happen is that a dealer on a market will be entering into a very large number of transactions to buy and sell all day. At the end of the day, it will then have a whole series of commitments which have to be completed dealing with another party. Rather than execute all of these contracts individually, what we can do is net down all the positions just to calculate what the residual situation condition is between any bilateral pair of operators on the specific market. So a particular broker dealer may be conducting markets, making markets all day in, let's say, 100 or 200 stocks. It is going to enter into thousands, if not tens of thousands of transactions to buy and sell. At the end of the day, it then looks at each of its other counterparties, trade counterparties, and it determines what they owe each other on a net basis. It may well be that there was $1 million of transactions conducted, $1 million was sold, $1,000,001 was purchased. Rather than complete execute all of those transactions, which is 2.1 or 2 million and one, you net down and there's only one due. And if the value of that is $1, there's only one payment which has to be made from one to the other and one share to be transferred. You net down the positions to make it much more efficient and much easier and cost effective to give effect to the final execution which is required. So we have pre-settlement clearing. The settlement itself is then the execution of the contracts entered into, and that simply involves the transfer of funds in exchange for the corresponding securities, the equity or the bonds. So settlement is the actual execution, transfer of funds in return for the physical securities or dematerialized securities. Clearing is the pre-settlement process that determines the net position between the counterparties in the specific market. We then have two other associated core functions. We have reporting, either for trade or transaction purposes. Trade reporting is to update the price, which goes back to point number one with regards to the core purpose being price disclosure. What we have to do on a continuous basis is update the price so it's most effective, most accurate at any point in time. So trade reporting goes back to the beginning, updates the price so it's almost at the most accurate and specific, relevant, valid level. But what we also have is we have regulatory reporting. And this is whereby the authorities, which will also include the specific stock market on which the securities have been admitted, is monitoring for malpractice or misconduct. The authorities and the markets themselves are always looking for any type of market manipulation or misconduct of any form. So what they're doing is they're going back over the transactions and they're reviewing them for any patterns which might indicate some form of misconduct or manipulation of any form. So we have reporting both for updating the price discovery as well as for regulatory and legal compliance. So what we can do simply is this: we can determine the specific functions of stock markets and exchanges. We can summarize all of this in terms of price discovery, trading and dealing, clearing, settlement, and then trade and transaction reporting. With regard to the actual conduct of the trading itself, we can then distinguish a number of key elements. We have this core division again that we've referred to between order and quote-driven systems. Traditionally, markets were order-based. The market would collect a series of buy and sell orders. When those orders matched, the transaction would be entered into, the transaction would be completed. That's effective, it operates perfectly well, it's stable, but it's a bit slow, it's a bit cumbersome, and it's almost accidental because you need parties to agree on the volume and the price. Modern markets are much more efficient, much more autonomous, because we have basically quote-driven systems. One of the parties will act as a market maker and is always offering a price to buy and a price to sell. This is the bid price and the offer price or the ask price. So we're making a market at all times. So we need to distinguish this. Many of the most sophisticated modern markets are still order-based. They're still matching, but they do it on an electronic basis. It's only in the most sophisticated systems that we get quote-driven systems, we get market making. Dealer markets essentially, this is the next section, dealer markets essentially operate on a market making basis where intermediaries offer continuous bid and ask prices in the same stock, which will be agreed at that time. As we've mentioned already, legally, these constitute offers to contract. So the other party has to accept the offer and then the contract's concluded. So just because there's offering, that of itself does not create the contract. And when the other party accepts, the other party is effectively offering to purchase and then you'll have the settlement, so it follows slightly afterwards. You also then have what we call limited order books, where transactions can be carried out on a continuous basis, but subject to putting in specific order instructions, and we'll come back and look at market orders in a couple of minutes. We've also got what we call open outcry markets. Open outcry or pit-based systems are the more old-fashioned markets. There's still a couple of them in the world. Some of the commodities markets still operate on this basis. That's where parties are physically in an arena together, and they're contracting and they're transacting, and they're using a lot of market signals to determine the volume, the price, and very often separate delivery or execution dates. So we've open outcry systems. Much of this has been replaced by electronic systems simply because it's much more efficient. There's much less possibility of making errors and mistakes, and it's much more efficient and it's much faster. We separately again have what we call call or batch trading. With call or batch trading, that's distinct from continuous trading. Call or batch, you will designate a particular time or period in which transactions are conducted, in which the order book applies. You're trying to match the transactions, or there's continuous pricing. It tends to be more commonly used with regards to order-based systems, but you'll conduct a market at a particular time. Very often what can happen, for example, is that the formal stock market and exchange is open at a particular time. And then again, at the beginning of that, you could have like a call or batch period. When the formal stock market closes and exchanges, closes at the end of the trading day, it can then very often be transferred onto some form of electronic continuous system after that as well. So you can get a combination of different types of trading practices as well with all of this. Now, we also have what we call market orders, which are the particular types of instructions which can be fed into systems. A market order is essentially an order to buy or sell a financial asset immediately at the best possible price. There's a whole series of terms that can be used. We have market orders, we have stop orders, we have difference orders, scale orders, swap orders. There's also other common terms of parlance which are used. All or nothing, fill or kill, at the close, immediate or cancel, good today, good until cancel, not held, participate but do not initiate. There's a whole series of instructions that can be used with regards to this. Essentially, a market order is for immediate settlement at best possible price. A limit order determines the best price, or it's the price or better. So a limit order will try to get a price, but it will wait till the specific figures arrived at. A buy limit order can be executed at or below the specified price, a sell limit order at or above. So it creates a range. You also then get what are called stop orders, which prevent further trading after a specific price is reached. And very often what can happen is that you'll combine the limit order with a stop order. So for example, if you're holding shares, what you want to do is this. You want to sell when the price rises to a specific amount. So that's a limit order. You've got a price limit order to sell. But what you'll also do is this. In case the market goes against you and starts to fall, you have a stop order, which puts a ceiling on the price in terms of what it can drop to. So you both the limit order in terms of what you want the market to rise to, at which time you will trade, but also you have a stop order which prevents the price going against you very substantially and significantly, which could create a very significant substantial loss. So you can combine the orders in combination as well. Now, very often what can happen in a number of these markets, especially with the use of these market orders and specifically limit and stop orders, is that they can be on the market for a long extended period of time. Very often, traders, including day traders, very commonly will put market limit orders on and limit and stop orders, and they could leave them there for months. There's even orders on systems which may be there for years, and only when the price moves to a certain figure will you buy or sell. And this happens very commonly. the rest of the chapter is then going to examine the background to emerging forms of financial technology, fintech, and regulatory technology, regtech, as well as more recent points of incidence and collapse, with specific reference to the global financial crisis and the key reforms and changes and revisions which are adopted in response to that. All of this is set out in further detail in the paper. As I've already explained, the second paper then looks at the nature of particular stock markets and exchanges in more detail. It's identifying some of the principal markets in the world and then considering some of the key historical and legal and regulatory issues that arise with regards to these. All of this is dealt with in further detail in the paper. Stock markets and exchanges are very important. We always need some form of either formal organized market or parallel over-the-counter market. It could be physical, it could be increasingly electronic, but we always need some place to buy and sell these core securities in any financial system. This is a core part of the operation of the system, whereby we ensure continuing price discovery, we ensure continuing tradability of itself, which then supports liquidity and marketability of the shares and stocks that we are dealing with. These have always been important and they will remain and continue to grow and develop. All I have then simply done is identify a number of other larger, more important, significant issues in this area, which I consider in further detail at the end of chapter 2, specifically with regards to increased digital competition, visual and financial innovation, capital role in private investment, especially with regard to the rise of private pension provision, and then how all of this ties into continuing financial security, financial stability, and then the importance of financial integration and global contribution. All of this is dealt with in further detail in the materials provided.